following is a message from Rishi T. Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Cares Veterinary Clinic, providing the highest level of veterinary care to pets throughout the Clinton Hill neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, and surrounding areas since its founding in 2008. For more information, visit brooklyncaresvet.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings, and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and today we're talking about racehorses. My guest is Barry Myers. Barry is an equine consultant with expertise in international transport, sales, and the purchase of performance horses. He's been working with horses for over 30 years and has owned many, including a few racehorses. Barry is a little unusual in the horse world, as he's worked and participated in a variety of equine sports, while most horse people usually stick to one. Barry has a passion for playing polo internationally, hunting, and breeding horses. He's an expert in the field of horse racing, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Hey, Barry, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. How's California doing today?
Well, it's warm and dry.
Sounds good to me. So I know a lot of...
Probably being... The dry part being less important than the warm today.
So. I hear you. We're still trying to get into summer, so we got dry, we got sunny, but we got warm and cool, too. So we're shifting a little bit. So I don't think Americans know that much about horse racing compared to people in other countries, so I want to get directly into this. Starting off, what kinds of horses breeds race?
Well, internationally, there's a few different variants of it, but primarily what we're looking at, for example, in this country would be thoroughbreds, standardbreds. We do have some Arabian racing. Quarter horse racing is quite popular. There's even Appaloosa racing, and some of the other breeds have paint racing. But certainly the largest participants would be thoroughbred and quarter horse and standardbreds.
Okay. And how old are they when they start training?
How old?
Yeah.
Well, using thoroughbreds as an example, many long yearlings, horses that are, say, would be a yearling, which would mean that they were born the previous year, sometime after January 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Following year, by fall, in this country, many of them are being broken in to saddle. So they wouldn't be 2 years old yet. They could be 18 months or even less. And people try to start them under saddle to get a foundation for them. They're not used for racing or anything strenuous.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to get them accustomed to things while they're still very impressionable and young.
Mm-hmm.
Where you've got a basis to go on with later.
Okay.
So, very often a horse will be broken in September, October, November, and then depending on how far along he or she is, they might be turned out, you know, let mature a little bit and
mm-hmm.
recover from the process, or maybe kept in light training until their two-year-old year, which in this country is January 1st.
Mm-hmm.
All thoroughbreds are a year old January 1st after the year they're born, technically.
Okay.
So some of them will go into racing. Some of them will go into sales. Some of them just don't have what it takes, and they'll be used for other purposes.
Mm-hmm. And are there certain traits that you see in the babies that show promise?
It takes a very good eye to pick out a successful, say, a weanling
mm-hmm.
for a baby and say this is going to be a very good racehorse. They go through so many changes as they mature. It takes a real a bit of luck and a bit of talent both to do that. Often these things are... They're bred and based on pedigree at that age as much as they are appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if a horse has got some sort of terrible defect, you know, it more or less eliminates them as a prospect. But by and large, weanlings are, you know, you could look at a crop and probably be wrong more often than right.
Mm-hmm. And so how much does pedigree have to do with a champion? Like, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a winner if you've got two top horses.
No, absolutely not. There was a very famous breeder in Kentucky many years ago. He used to say, you breed the best to the best and you hope for the best.
Mm.
And I think that's probably a very good way to look at it. There's a great deal of luck involved in this, and skill and timing and everything else is wonderful to have. But as we've seen with a lot of the more prominent races lately, they're not necessarily stellar bloodlines or pedigrees that have become famous.
Yeah, yeah. And then do mares race, or is this only a stallion thing?
No. There's... In American racing, you have fillies and mares, and you have colts, geldings, and a whole horse. Or mm-hmm. Stallion technically would be an animal that has been bred, a male that has been bred. So the term horse actually indicates that it's a whole and intact male.
Oh.
It hasn't been used as a stallion yet. Or a stud colt, that it doesn't mean he's been bred. But certainly mares, one of the best horses we've had in the U.S. in the last decade or so, was a mare named Zenyatta,
mm-hmm.
who is retired now, and she was an absolutely incredible mare, and she used to race against the boys on occasion and did a pretty good job of putting them in their place.
Nice.
And she's not the only one. There's been some very, very good mares. There have been... Phillies won the Kentucky Derby, and so you don't want to discount them due to sex,
right?
And also, in this country, there is a high percentage of altered males, geldings, that race. Certain other countries have a kind of a dim view of doing that, because some of the more prominent races, you want a stallion to win so that you can continue. And at least in theory, those pedigrees that were able to reach that level of expertise. But in this country, geldings have a pretty big place along a lot of other ones. Smarty Jones, who won the Derby a few years ago, he was a gelding.
Hmm. And why are they gelding in this country?
I'm sorry?
Why are they gelding racehorses?
I'm sorry. Let me change this just a second.
Okay.
Say again, please.
Why are they gelding racehorses if they're so young?
Why are they starting them when they're that young?
No, why are they gelding them? Why are they castrating them?
Well, a lot of the problems associated with stallions come to the fore early on.
Mm.
Sometimes actually physical limitations that the horse's body puts on itself makes gelding kind of a requirement for the horse to race properly. There's been some pretty decent racehorses in the States that had excellent pedigrees, but had issues with interference,
mm-hmm.
to put it bluntly. a very common reason to do it is because of problems of temperament.
Mm-hmm.
Intact horses or colts often carry peculiarities related to hormonal levels that
yeah.
make them difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
And if the horse doesn't show an incredible amount of promise, sometimes that's something that's done.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally a horse that somebody had thought would make a great racehorse and isn't quite living up has been gelded and has been a better racehorse for it.
Wow.
So
it's really interesting because, as you know, I come from the hunter-jumper world, and I mean, you know, 99% of the male horses are gelded immediately, and if you're under 18, you can't ride a male horse that isn't gelded. So it's interesting to see the differences in the different equine sports.
Yes, there's no... In at least in racing, there's no barriers against racing geldings against colts or colts against geldings.
Mm-hmm.
There's no there's no requirement or any particular standard that requires you to do that.
Mm-hmm. And then because they're training them when they're really, really young, do they ever worry about getting them hurt? Or because, you know, they're still growing and stuff. Like, is that when they give them a break and put them out to pasture?
Depending on the circumstances, yes. Certainly the youth and the immaturity of a lot of the animals is a risk. To a large extent, though, racing is based, it's a age-related sport.
Mm-hmm.
All of the classic races, the Derby, the Preakness, the Belmont, all the Oaks races for fillies, those are all three-year-old races.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a long-standing tradition. And so, I mean, for a horse to be able to, the first Saturday in May, go out and be competitive, he's got to have a pretty good foundation and pretty good background in racing already.
Yeah, seriously.
So, I mean, when you look at hunter jumpers, you know, if you had a three-year-old out there, you'd be pre-green.
Yeah, forget it. I mean, it would just be a disaster.
Yeah, and probably half mad to be trying it. So.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, most of the horses by the time they came to us were, a young one was four. I was usually get them between like 6 and 9, you know.
Right.
So we never dealt with babies unless somebody bred one on the farm and they were training it to be a hunter jumper.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And the bones are all set at that age, certainly by five.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, the bones are all set. The horse is completely mature physically and mentally. So you've basically got a finished product other than the refinements you put on him to do the job you want him to.
You know, that's a really good point because, you know, you're racing these really young horses. Like, how much of the game for the horses is mental?
How much of the what is
how much of this game or the racing for horses is really mental? I mean, you're dealing with real babies there, like keeping them concentrated.
In my opinion, however mistaken I might be, I think that the mental aspect is of huge consideration. I've been fortunate in shipping career to have flown whole bunches of very, very good racehorses.
Mm-hmm.
Affirmed being one of them.
Oh, wow.
And, Affirmed at 3, at 2 even, when he used to fly.
Mm-hmm.
He was more mentally settled and mature than many, many horses 5 and 6 years of age. And I think that some runners, just like in jumpers and people, they're their own worst enemy. They let their minds get kind of in the way of production.
Mm-hmm.
But the very best of all the runners I've ever handled took everything in stride. They were pretty measured. They responded rather than reacted to situations.
Wow.
Which you'd want to see in a jumper as well.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I had a hunter jumper that was off the track, and he really was his own worst enemy when it came to hunter classes. He'd be perfect, 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 and at the last second, crow hop or swat or, you know, do a little tiny buck, and it was like, damn it, there goes the class, you know, every time. So, yeah, and it was, he was like, I'm being good, I'm being good, I'm being good, I can't anymore, you know, and he tried, but... Usually it was just, he just had to play. So, I mean, in the racing world, that's why actually he went off the track was because he wasn't focused enough and would play and actually got a jockey very, very injured. So I think that ended his career quite quickly.
And the horses get a bad reputation and it's difficult to go on with them successfully.
Hmm. Makes sense.
But I think some horses leave the, I mean, you watch a post parade going out to a race, for example, and you see a horse that's becoming all lathered up. He's sweated up everywhere. He looks like he's just run a marathon before he started to race.
Yep.
Well, that's a mental problem within the horse. And, you know, he's left his race probably on the track before he ever set foot in the starting gate.
Definitely, because he's so strung out that he's probably used half his energy through stress.
Right. And I think... Mostly that sort of mental makeup and everything a horse is born with, much like a person is. You can probably get things calmed down and such, but the running spirit in everything in most horses is, you know, directly related to the the mental attitude and what sort of mentality they have to begin with. So I think there are probably a number of horses that could be champions if their minds would let them.
I hear you. I hear you. I think it's the same way with people, too, in many cases.
I think you're right.
Hey, Barry, we have to take a break for station identification, but we'll be back in one moment to continue this conversation, so just hang on.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Animal Instinct is brought to you today by Brooklyn Cares Veterinary Clinic. Since 2008, Brooklyn Cares has been providing exceptional veterinary care to pets throughout Brooklyn, New York. Led by doctors Timothy Mann and Stephanie Liff, the practice advocates a gentle, holistic approach to caring for your pet and offers an impressive breadth of basic and advanced healthcare services for your dog or cat. This modern practice, conveniently located in the Clinton Hill neighborhood of Brooklyn, is fully equipped with state-of-the-art equipment to ensure that your pet receives the highest quality care, regardless of whether they're sick or injured, or simply visiting for annual wellness checkup. For more information, visit BrooklynCaresVet.com.
And we're back, talking to Barry Myers all about racehorses. Let's see, Barry, I want to talk a little bit about their care. The hunters and jumpers are taken care of like the best prima ballerina on the planet. I mean, best food, best everything, best grooms, best grooming, any kind of therapies that they can get, that sort of thing. And a lot of times they're really treated like pets as well. Are racehorses treated more like livestock or pets?
Well, I think it depends on the horse, depends on the stable he's stabled with, and it depends on the owner.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, it's been my experience that many of the horses in training at the racetrack are very fawned on, and certainly well looked after. But I mean, a happy horse is always easier to be around, is easier to deal with.
Yeah, that's true.
And by and large, the better horses are the horses that have been in the stable for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They have one groom that looks after them, and the groom might have two or three or four, maybe just one horse that is his to look after.
Mm-hmm.
And they form a pretty good bond between them. So I'd say when they're in the stable, they're closer to a pet, although they don't all qualify for that.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, by and large, they're very well looked after. You don't walk through a barn at, say, Belmont or Aqueduct and see horses that that show signs of having been neglected in any way.
Yeah,
you know, it's more or less contrary to having something productive happen with them anyway. So
true. And so what kind of care does a typical racehorse get? Like, what is a day in the life of a racehorse typically?
Well, happily, it's been a long time since I've worked on the track in the barn, but mm-hmm. I have done. But basically, they're fed early the morning, 3:30, 4 o'clock perhaps latest.
Oh, wow.
And they get a good mash in the morning. These were the barns I've worked in the past.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 o'clock, training starts, at least out here on the West Coast, and the typical racehorse will unless there's something particularly tiring or perhaps an acute injury,
mm-hmm.
You don't stall rest them at all. They're at the very least they're going to walk. They're going to walk a half an hour or 40 minutes with somebody handling them, mm-hmm. either on a hot walking machine or an individual that walks them, called a hot walker,
mm-hmm.
which the machines are named after. By and large, most of them will gallop in the morning. And depending on the length of training, the horse is set up to run in, or the type of horse he is, he's going to gallop a mile or better in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Let's use a mile for... But this is not going to be a run. This is just a gallop. It's just to get out and keep everything moving, keeping him fit.
Okay.
Occasionally, a horse will get ponied rather than be galloped with a rider on. And so somebody will go out with a pony and lead him around at a certain speed.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, they'll do a workout where a horse goes out and goes a specific distance for time. It's generally a race prep, and to tell you how far along the horse is and how competitive he'll be and whether it's not time to put him in a race, or perhaps he needs a little more training in between.
Mm-hmm.
If a horse were to race today, chances are tomorrow he would just walk. He might walk for the next 2 or 3 days just to sort of recover from the rigors of the race. And then he'd be put back into under saddle and gallop and such. And that's pretty much a daily routine for them. None of them stay in the barn all day long. Some of them get out in the afternoon and are walked around mm-hmm. as well. So, there's a little bit of privation in the fact that the box stalls and the stalls and the racetracks aren't huge, but... they're all out of there at least at some point during every day for probably an hour at the very least.
That's great. And then,
some jumpers get, actually.
It is better than some jumpers get, definitely. Definitely. I mean, you know, depending on a show horse, like a show jumper, their typical days, thank God, usually started at 7 a.m. because I was a groom for years, so I'm grateful that I got to get up at 6 instead of 4. And we do breakfast at 7, and then about 9, turn them out, do the stalls, and then usually hack them or ride them at some point in the afternoon, bathe them, turn them out for a little bit, give them dinner, and then they're in for the night. So it's definitely the racehorses seem to be outside a lot more than that. And like the Grand Prix horses, when they do the huge competitions, usually the day after that, they're pretty much the same thing, just walked maybe 20 minutes, if that, and just, you know, letting them just recuperate and just let their muscles come back and all that.
Right. On the other hand, though, a Grand Prix horse, by and large, is going to be more settled mentally. I mean, he's going to be sort of a more routine sort of animal.
True.
So.
True, and they're older, too, and a lot of them have come off the track. So I think that...
That's true.
Yeah, the Grand Prix horses are really interesting. Their attitude is they emulate so much confidence. Like, they know what they're doing, and they're like, I can jump that 6-foot wall, no problem. How about you?
Yeah.
You know,
it's like... It's a good thing to have that attitude, too.
Thank God. I mean, we had a couple real brats at the barn, and they're so difficult to handle. And that's what I thought with the racehorses, because they're so young that you'd have a lot of just attitude and spookiness and that sort of thing, and more so than the hunter jumpers, just based on age.
Right. Age and experience does a great deal for a horse. Certainly on the racetrack, you do have some fractious behavior. And the youth is a big part of that. And the fact that the horses, by and large, are very, very fit and, you know, ready to go out and race or expend a lot of energy. And it's going to get released in some form.
Yeah.
Certainly, when you put these things on airplanes, you don't see them always at their best.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of circumstances there where between noise and hustle and bustle and just seeing new things... It's a lot for a horse to take in, especially a young one.
And so in cases like that, will you tranquilize, or is that just a really bad idea?
Preferably not.
Yeah.
If a horse is going somewhere to race, then tranquilizing him is out.
Oh, that's right.
Stuff will stay in the bloodstream for some time. So you try to ameliorate, you know, the circumstances and the annoyances as much as you can prior.
Mm-hmm.
Some horses are tranquilized to transport, but it wouldn't be to go to a race anywhere. It would be for other circumstances.
So, because the only information I have of this is a bad version of International Velvet, that movie that came out in the 70s?
I had heard about that. I never did watch it. I think when I read about it, I was amused to the point where I didn't watch it.
It's terrible, okay? I mean, I was a little kid riding ponies, and I knew how bad this movie was, okay? So it's like, for horse people, it was kind of like, okay.
Not a good endorsement for transporting your horse, so.
No, and that's the whole thing, because if, for the people that have not seen this spectacular film, they're shipping the horses by air, and one of the horses completely freaks out, and so what they wind up doing is putting the animal down. Is that what happens?
I was involved in air transport very closely for over 30 years, and I can think of a very, very small handful of circumstances where something like that was done.
Mm-hmm.
And it, none of them were jumpers. There was one horse coming up from South America, a polo pony coming up for the Cup of the Americas in 1979, mm-hmm. late 79 to early 1980. And there's been a couple trans-Tasman circumstances going between New Zealand and Australia, and there's always the odd circumstance that would require that. But by and large, transport agents and the people on the airplanes don't carry things to accomplish that particular task because it is so rare.
Yeah.
The sort of things you need to dispatch a horse under those circumstances are pretty unpleasant, and very often the circumstances wouldn't allow you to implement them anyway.
That's a good point.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, everyone that transports horses, especially, I mean, any horse transporter on the planet, that's good. And all the air transporters, they've been doing it for a long time, so they know what they're doing. You know, this isn't like, first day on the job, transporting horses to Europe. You know, it's never going to happen.
It wouldn't probably be your first task at the job that day.
Yeah.
The beauty of land transport is, you know, if you have a real problem, you can stop somewhere and take it off.
Yeah.
And your options on an airplane are far limited. So that
now,
changes things.
Have you ever had to land early because of a situation?
Occasionally something like that does happen. About 30 years ago, there was a horse that had come up from Argentina, went through quarantine in Florida, and was en route to California, and it took exception to something on the aircraft.
Oh, no.
And started to take apart its surroundings, and they made a non-scheduled landing in Texas en route.
Wow.
And the horse had a few cuts on it, but it wasn't anything particularly nasty, but it may have been with a little more time. And about 10 days later, the horse finished the trip out to California in good order, and it's hard to tell what would have set her off.
Yeah.
You know, you don't always know. I wasn't with the animal during the initial thing, but the groom that went with her was an Irish fellow who had about 25 years experience flying with horses.
Oh, wow.
It was just an oddity, hopefully.
I mean, that's got to be so scary. I can't even imagine.
Better not to.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think we're going to change the subject. Actually, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, as in the hunter and jumper world and a lot of the other horse worlds besides racing, the owners are usually very involved, and a lot of times they're actually the rider. How present are owners in the racing world?
I'll tell you, you run through the whole spectrum with that. You get some owners that are very hands-on, that know the horses very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps they were the owner and the breeder as well. They may have planned to, you know, to have a horse as a three-year-old. They may have planned that horse 5 years prior.
Right.
They take a very direct approach. There's a number of owners like that. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you could have owners and you could show them three horses and they wouldn't be able to tell you which was theirs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it varies a great deal. To some people, even true of jumpers as well and hunters, they're just a commodity or they're an entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly enough jumper owners and such that you know, they know what they own, they know the name of the horse, but they're perhaps not horsemen or horsewomen, and they don't ride, and they wouldn't be able to.
Totally. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of owners like that. I mean, it's, you know, one of the reasons of the Hampton Classic is you really see it there. You know, it's more so than it indoors of, you know, oh, well, that's my horse and that sort of thing. Where it becomes a status thing, you know, but it's like they don't even know their horse. It's really interesting. You know, it's like a, it's almost, it turns it into more of a commodity. I feel like it's no longer an animal, then it's like a vehicle.
Oh, sure. You know, if it's something you really enjoy, then it's, you know, you're going to be very directly involved. And if it's just a commodity, it's just like having a car or something else. And you don't hold it in this, quite the same consideration that you would as a horseman or as a breeder.
Yeah. And so who owns racehorses these days? Is it people who know them, or is it more corporations and investors?
It's, that has changed considerably over, I don't know, perhaps the last 50 years to a great extent. Back 50 years ago or so, there might be a few partnerships, but generally speaking, they were owned by an individual or a farm, and the farm, of course, would have been owned by an individual or some people that had the wherewithal and the knowledge to pick out the right one and have somebody else train it for them and such. But anymore, syndicates and partnerships have become very, very common. Rather than just have one person own them, if you look down the racing form page and you look at the owners, you'll see sometimes four or five owners or some racing partnership, this or that, and there's no telling how many people might actually have a percentage interest in the animal on occasion.
Wow.
And in some ways it works out well if, you know, if you're a partner with, say, six or ten other people, and everybody puts up X amount of dollars, you might be able to run three or four horses and have something come out of it that's really a stellar sort of individual rather than putting all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, you could get a bunch of people that have a bunch of horses and invest in each. It's kind of like the stock market in a sense that way.
It is a bit. It's just that, horses are even more fragile than stock.
Isn't that the truth? They're moodier too. So, I mean, I know this is such a broad question, but, I mean, how much does it typically cost to raise and train a racehorse?
Well, that there's a huge variance of possibility, but by and large, depending on where the horse is kept and how well it's kept, and you're probably going to be looking at... There, I'll give you an example. There's a farm in Kentucky I used for many years. They ran quarantine work for me, and they would board horses for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the rate could vary. It could be $15 a day, and during quarantine, it'd go up to $25 or $30, depending mm-hmm. on circumstances, sometimes more. On the racetrack, I think a pretty good average right now, this was a few years ago, was to keep a horse in training for a year, and generally speaking, there'd be time off of this, you're looking at about $40,000.
Wow.
And sometimes more, very easily more.
Yeah.
Some trainers getting $125, $150 a day. And so that, and when you add to that shoeing, which is going to be at the very least every month.
Yeah.
And vet care and... just moving the horse one place to another.
Yep, and food.
When you add it all together, people look at a racing form and it's sort of misleading. It looks, you look and you see this horse has won you $50,000 in the last year. You think, well, he must be pretty nice. Well, that horse probably didn't pay all his bills.
Yeah.
If you look at it that way.
Totally, and it's the same in the hunters and the jumpers, the Grand Prix. It might be, you know, a $75,000 Grand Prix to win it, but, like, how much have you put into this horse in the year? Just,
oh, exactly.
You know, it's like, we're breaking even, all right.
Yeah, and in this case, if the horse wins $50,000, 10% is going to the trainer, depending on the circumstance.
Oh, yeah.
Between 5 and 10%, that goes to the jockey as well. So you've lost at least 15% off the top.
Totally.
You've got to have a passion for the sport, I think, if you're going to have any enjoyment out of it at all.
I think so too, and I think that, you know, it's a very, very sexy sport, and I think that, you know, over the years, I think that just because of everything else that we have in this country, I think it's kind of losing popularity a little bit, just because there's so many other things to watch and see and do. You know, I feel like horses are starting to, people are losing more touch with horses because they're no longer a method of transportation. You know, most of us don't have farms in Brooklyn anyway. So, you know, horses are, I feel like in the past 50 years, there's been a real change in the attitude towards horse racing. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think has changed in the sport over the years?
Well, many things have changed in the sport. Part of it is the ownership, as we discussed just briefly mm-hmm. before. There are far fewer racetracks now than there were, say, 50 years ago. California here, we had five major racetracks. Up until about 5 years ago, now we're down to three major tracks.
Wow.
So we had a 40% reduction in the amount of venues. Mind you, they didn't run in opposition to one another, but still, when a racetrack might be 50 or 60 miles from another one, you draw in an entirely or a large percentage of your populace or your viewers are going to be from a different area.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's more proximal and easier to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But again, say 40 or 50 years ago or so, if you wanted to bet on anything in California, you bet on a racehorse, or you went to one of these little card parlors, which were legal in certain areas, and you played a few cards, or you went to Las Vegas, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got online betting and so many other pursuits that are easily accessible to everyone. In addition, you've got so many more things to go see and to look at. And going to the races in the 50s, I mean, that was a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
That many other spectator sports. Now you've got myriad professional sports teams, and you got television covering virtually all of them.
Yeah.
And it just makes it completely... if you don't have a passion for going to see them, then it's an encumbrance because you have to park, you have to pay to get there and everything else where you can just turn on the television.
Yeah.
Television coverage of horse racing is not kept up even close to what we have for, you know, any other professional sport virtually.
Yeah, it's true.
And then I think you guys have... in New York and virtually all the states have some form of lottery. So you're, if you had $50 you were going to bet at the racetrack, you can just go and get scratchers now for $50. And
totally.
Immediate satisfaction. You don't have to know anything.
It's true. It's true. And so if you go to a track on just a regular race day, not like Belmont or the Derby or the Stakes, is there a crowd?
It's weather driven.
Okay.
Times, and certainly location makes a difference. Churchill Downs is usually pretty well attended. I've been there many times whenever it hasn't been a major race.
Mm-hmm.
Keeneland Racetrack in Lexington is very well attended, but it's a fairly short meet, so it draws in people, and that's an area that's based almost entirely on a horse economy as well, which makes a difference.
Mm, that's a good point.
Santa Anita out here, which is an absolutely gorgeous racetrack in Arcadia, on the big days when the Breeders' Cup is there, it's standing room only. But a lot of other days, the attendance is pretty marginal. And we see that more and more.
Yeah, you see that at Belmont a lot.
Belmont's a gorgeous racetrack as well.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And I think Aqueduct would fall more in. They'd have probably less involvement from people than Belmont would, even just because Belmont has an ambience about it that is comfortable.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And, you know, the history. The problem with Belmont is that it's not the most convenient place to get to. And so I think that's another big problem.
You do have a train that goes right by there, though. That makes it kind of nice.
That helps. That helps a lot. So,
here in California, Del Mar, which it runs more or less like Saratoga. It starts in summer and then runs to almost fall or right around sometime early fall.
Mm-hmm.
It is I have not been there in the last 10 years when there hasn't been an excellent crowd there.
Oh, that's good to hear.
It's a lot of that is, I think, because of its location. I mean, it's so close to San Diego, it's very easy to get to.
Mm-hmm.
And the same people that might want to go to Del Mar, it would be too arduous a trip to make it up to Los Angeles for another racetrack.
Mm.
So.
And so what happens to racehorses after they leave the track?
Well, it would depend on the individual, but let's see. I mean, if it's a male horse, an intact horse, and there's any sort of pedigree, there's always a market for the breeding industry.
Mm-hmm.
And same with a filly or a mare. Virtually all of them, you know, will have some following. Somebody will like certain pedigrees, and they might not be in this country. I mean, there's a lot of racehorses that are shipped abroad, ex-racehorses, to become breeding stock in other countries.
Oh, wow.
And even Turkey has a fairly strong thoroughbred industry.
Wow.
I mean, you don't hear about that much, but...
No, I mean, I've heard a lot about Dubai and Hong Kong.
Right.
Which, I mean, they're no-brainers. They're both such wealthy areas that, you know, horse racing.
But Hong Kong doesn't actually breed anything. There's no room there for it. They buy virtually all geldings or more inclined to colts.
Wow.
And that's sort of what they're set up for. You've got two racetracks there and very little land to go anywhere with. Now that it's part of the mainstay China,
yeah,
and there's more latitude. But basically, horses that went over there, that was fairly limited what their future was going to be.
Mm.
I mean, they don't have a breeding industry. Japan has got a substantial breeding industry. And they do very well. In racing in Japan, they still talk about it falling down, but for considering the size of the country, it's got a large population, certainly, but there is over twice as much bet on racing in Japan as there is in the U.S.
Wow.
In fact, they lead the world. We're number two.
Wow.
So when you think about it that way, you've got to realize how popular the over there.
I'm not in a million years what I was expecting you to say that. I'm really, really surprised.
When you look at the numbers, they're kind of eye-opening. But they've been, Japan and a few other places have been buying some of our better horses up over the years, and sometimes quietly. The horse that won the Derby and the Preakness 2 years ago, I'll have another, he went to Japan.
Wow.
And a number of other very famous horses have gone over there over the years.
And so for like our races like the Belmont, the Preakness, the Derby, can there be like international entries to that?
Yes. Yeah, no, there absolutely is. There are avenues by which a horse can come from another country and race here and vice versa. Japan has, you have the Dubai World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And a few other races over there that they will invite people to come, and if you want to come, then they facilitate that trip. Japan has the Japan Cup, and there's two of them now. There's one called the Japan Cup Dirt, and there's the other one that's on grass.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically pay all the expenses for the horse to go to Japan. And they pay for the trainer, the exercise boy, the owner.
Wow.
Entourage, they put up the hotel, they pay for the flight, all the quarantine charges, everything.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Wow. So how do you get invited to that?
You need the right horse, or what they think will be the right horse. So it depends on the racing record and of the horse here. And they'll invite from Europe, from Canada, from the U.S. They'll pay for it all. They all get there, and then you do your best.
And then they beat them all.
And then when it's done, they fly you all the way back home.
That's unbelievable.
That's an expensive process, to say the least, and they don't do anything halfway for that.
I admire that. And I'm just, you know, the vision in my head is like racing in the 50s here, of people dressed to the nines, and it's a very glamorous evening, and, you know, fancy, unlike what Belmont's become at this point, unfortunately, and very sadly.
Yes. Oh, lovely place, though.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, I saw Seattle Slough there when I was a little kid, and so Belmont has a very, very special place in my heart.
Yeah, that was nice. That would have been 77.
It was a long time ago. I know that, and I was a little kid. And unfortunately, all I could see was his drapes. They wouldn't even let me meet the horse, but it was cool. It was good.
He was a nice boy, that, actually.
I liked him.
After he went to stud, I was lucky enough to visit him a few times, and he was pretty even-tempered for what he was and what he did.
That's amazing.
Not all stallions remain that way.
No,
sure you're aware.
You know, after working with the Hunters and the Jumpers, and there were a couple stallions, once in a blue moon in the Jumpers, and it's like one of our clients had one, and he was just, I mean, he's a stallion. You know, it's like a jock on steroids. And it would just, you know, I'm not walking over there. I'm going to run you down, you know, or I'm going to bite you, or I'm going to misbehave. And my neck is so thick and I'm so strong. There's nothing you can do about it. So
no, there's not a great deal. No, there's some of them, they're bent on getting your attention one way or another.
Oh. Yeah, I feel like the stallions are more high maintenance than the geldings. I feel it's kind of like, hey. But
actually, geldings will outlive a stallion, too, on an average, quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah, it's. I suspect there's enough studies done on, but it has to do with secondary sexual characteristics and musculature and heart problems and such.
Interesting.
A few other things, so... but a horse that might live to be 20, 22 as a stallion... would probably make it to 25-30 as a gelding.
Wow. Well, that's a good reason to geld then, I'll tell you.
That and temper both.
Yeah, seriously, because there's nothing worse than a nasty, angry horse. There really isn't.
You had asked about what happens to them after racing. There are a number of adoption agencies for ex-runners, and it's the best polo ponies I've ever owned are off the track. They're X-track horses, certainly. Mm-hmm. You've seen a number of them in the jumper world and the hunter world.
Definitely.
And other performance horses as well. They, I mean, there's some of them just actually make very good hack horses. It's just what they do. But
yeah.
It's not an uncommon thing to have an ex-thoroughbred be somebody's riding horse. You see, and on the racetrack, some of them, the ones that really like the track life, the lead ponies on the racetrack and the outrider ponies are ex-runners.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. I love it. Barry, I hate to say it, we are out of time, but I thank you so much for talking to us. I learned so much about this.
I appreciate the opportunity. And I just wanted to mention, earlier I'd mentioned Smarty Jones being a gelding. I don't know what I had in my mind. That would have been funny side. Oh, somebody, the connections of Smarty Jones should probably be not pleased about hearing that.
It's like, what? I'm like, wait a minute.
What happened to my horse?
Yeah, really? Nobody told me. That's it. Well, Barry, thank you again so much. I learned so much from this. I'm so excited to share this information with everyone. I hope you have a great summer, and we will talk soon. So take care, huh?
Thanks very much. You have a good afternoon.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.